Hi, this is John Bramblett. I'm a visually impaired artist, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Okay, hello everybody. It's I don't even know what episode it is. Hello again. We're just pumping quarantine casts out like it's our job here. So
it's the virus itself.
Exactly. We're spreading it, putting it. Our numbers are just going up and more frequent. And you guys can't get rid of us. There's no cure for us at the moment either.
Yeah, if you don't keep 6 feet away from somebody while listening to this cast, we're just going to infect another person. So you really have to be careful when you're listening to us, man.
It'd be pretty awesome if our cast, like, if someone was listening on their phone and they got, like, 6 feet close to them, it turned on the cast in somebody else's, like, earphones.
Yeah, like somebody's, like, walking on the street and a guy drives by and he's like, what the hell?
Exactly. What is this? What is this? Exactly. That's our goal. We got to invent that technology. But, you know, I think Zoltan Istvan told us something. There was some kind of technology like that and whatnot. But welcome back, everyone. Or if you're just tuning in, this is Verbal Shenanigans. That is Mike. I am Scott. We are a weekly. Currently, during the pandemic, we're gonna try to be bi-weekly or twice a week. Wait, bi-week? No, bi-weekly would be every 2 weeks. So
yeah. Half a weekly? is that a term?
I don't know, but we're going to be something weekly. We're going to do 2 episodes a week. We have a lot of guests backlogged also, so it's pretty, I guess it's a really good problem for us.
Yeah, and we're not keeping track, so you might get a duplicate without us realizing.
Yeah, that's fine. But we're like,
in fact, we're going to have a contest for the first person who actually acknowledges, hey, wait a minute, this person's been on already. You'll get a grand prize.
Yeah. We'll send you a t-shirt right away because I have tons of them sitting in the garage right now. So, guys, you can message me. I'll probably just send you one for free. But
yeah.
So it is, still the apex of the pandemic here and, staying busy, Burley. I see you were staying busy by running in your living room, huh?
Yeah.
I don't think I could do that.
I've been having a little tough time, I would say, this week. I'm a kind of guy, I kind of got like an ADHD kind of brain pattern where I need multiple things going on to keep my brain stimulated.
Right.
So since there's a lot of limitations, it kind of hinders me. And then when there's limits on stuff, I don't like to do things unless it's like meets my requirements of stuff. Like I do walk in our neighborhood a lot, but my biggest thing is we got like crazy hills in our, that was my wife chiming in, hills and idiots, as we say, but, my big thing was like, we used to run through here all the time, and there was a period where I had a knee problem, and I think it's really constantly going in the back of my mind, so I don't like to do like a full like exercise run, and there's no real great place to go. So, I mean, I did it in the living room to kind of say, all right, I got to get the heart pumping. I got to get steps in. I gotta at least try stuff. It wasn't half bad.
Really?
It wasn't as, I mean, I've done it before. The wife does it a lot. She did a half marathon in the living room today. That's
like prison. That's like a prison workout.
Yeah, pretty much. That's all right. You get the yard for an hour and it's nothing but gates. And she's like, okay, boss. And she just keeps on running around.
After maybe 3 to 4 laps, I would be over it and dizzy.
It never affects me, dizziness. Once you get in a zone, you're okay, but you gotta find that kind of balance, whether if you're like a music listener or you just want those get your brain kind of silent where you're relaxing. That's where I gotta kind of lead things with my brain.
Do you listen to our back catalog while you're running? I think that would really get you going.
Well, I basically have the wife chase me with a playing device, and I just keep sprinting to try to get away.
Right, right.
It's like, no, I don't want to listen to that one again. No,
does she? Does she chase you with the Ray Hollett episode?
She chases me with the Ghost Cast. Oh, okay. I go double time on that one, and since it's a small living room, I run too fast, and I almost circle my way back to her, so I run in back, and I do semicircle half marathons.
Now, we're like 280-something in here. I could say we've only had like 10 and under episodes that I really just didn't enjoy that much, but I would say the rest of them, I never really had a problem with too many of them.
No, I mean, we joke from time to time on certain ones, but I would say for the most part, like something where I would look back and say, oh my God, you would have to pay me to re-listen to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very handful. I mean, maybe not all classics, but definitely not all stuff where it's like, all right, you can't get anything out of this.
That's our new description. Verbal Shenanigans, very handful, amount of bad podcasts. Very handful. That's a new one. I like it.
B-H-A-O-B-P. Yep, that's our motto.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so again, if you're tuning in, like, this is kind of what we do. We've had a lot of the show has gone through, I guess we can't say it's gone through different formats, but we used to like pile in guests three at some points on episodes, which is just really stupid planning on our part. I'll take the blame for that one. We used to like cram them in, and I don't know, it just became a thing, like, oh, we'll get two guests per episode, and it just, I don't know, it's like really dumb. Some of the episodes were like 2 hours, 3 hours long. It just really didn't make much sense. But we're back today with, I believe this is what, 286 or something like that? Something crazy, man.
We're getting there, Scott. We're going to magical number 300.
With the amount of guests we have backlogged, we might already be there. I'm not quite sure. But I mean, I'm going to end this podcast with a major podcast announcement. I'm just going to tell you that. I'm going to leave it on the table here. I'm going to let it simmer while we talk.
Is it my contract extension?
We're also going to see if anybody actually stays to the end of the podcast. So it's another social experiment here. But major, major announcement at the end of this show here. So, Berlo, hope your mind is running here.
Is it as major as the fact that 286 is an area code in North Carolina? So shout out to my Northy Carries.
North Cackalackians, you know?
Yo.
I do know, we're not very big in Idaho, if I remember. Hawaii doesn't like us much. But, you know, North Carolina is one of our power markets.
Absolutely. That's why we put our best episodes, which match up to their area codes. That's our plan all along. And I think Idaho's in like the 500 range. So 300 episodes from now, we're going to just pound those potato heads to death with amazing material.
Yeah. So although this pandemic is a lot of downtime, I've had a couple really busy days, which is kind of weird to say. I even put a video about it. The other day, I don't know, Berlo, if you've ever really soaked your hands into a power washer before, if you've really ever had the joy of just blasting things with a power washer.
I've done my house. I pondered whether I'm going to do my deck yet or not. I got to do a paint job on my deck.
You got to power wash it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to get it. You got to get it nice and clean.
Yeah, it gets dirty.
Yeah, you got to clean that dirt off.
Why don't you tell me how dirty my deck is, Scotty?
Now, there's something about a power washing to me is just like this cathartic, like therapeutic kind of thing where it's just you've claimed that you like to watch ice melt. You like to pour water over ice and watch it melt.
I like to want melt ice in the sink. Right. If people at work poured ice into the sink, I have to melt it. Yes.
So you know that feeling it gives you, maybe that soothing feeling or whatever feeling it gives you. For me, when I'm able to see the brick and I'm power washing maybe my brick pet, my driveway, and I could see what the old brick looks like and the new brick look and how it's coming clean, it is like I could feel my chakras aligning. I could feel my thoughts becoming one. I feel more in tune with the earth. I think if this whole comedy thing and everything else doesn't work, I think I could just power wash people's property for a living.
My brother does that on the side. That's good money right there.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just the euphoria of like doing some major work with like limited abilities?
Maybe it is. Maybe it's, I think it's like, for me, it was a time like I was out there probably 6 hours the other day going on the house, the driveway, the stones, the whatever I could really find. I didn't even finish. I finished today actually. And I just, for me, it was like time away from looking at my stupid cell phone, time away from sitting inside, time like, I don't know, to watch things just get clean. And I got obsessive over it. Like if I couldn't get a spot, I was trying all the different tips and nozzles. Like certain ones do like little circle things and they're able to clean pretty well, but others get angles and they can get under your siding really well. And I just dove completely in, and I was covered head to toe in mud, and I was starting to learn like patterns. If I did the ground first, it was a stupid move because then I would get no. If I did the siding first and then the ground, dumb move, because as I would cleaning the ground, all the mud would splash up all over the side of the house. I was learning like technique and what not to do. And I don't know, dude. I think I've found my new passion.
You were building best practices as you were going along.
Right. Like maybe to be more efficient. Yeah.
It's like when you see the dirt from the ground going up on the siding, you get this euphoria of like, my God, if I do it in the opposite order, this will be perfect.
I don't know, man. The sun was shining. I had like my Yeti full of coffee. And I did see like in some ways the dirt would go back onto the house and be like, oh, well, I guess I get to wash the house again. Like it was almost like, oh, I didn't even mind it. But yes, if I was timed and I was doing it for money, and time is money, I would recommend people who are, I know most people come to this show for their yard work tips and tricks.
Absolutely.
I would recommend you do the ground and the brick first because it kicks up so much crap.
Now, do you fear that you enjoyed so much if you did it as a job, like people would come out and see you flinging dirt on the house so you can like put in a couple extra hours to the task?
I think like people might like be like, is this guy done yet? Like, like what is he doing? Like, and they look at it and be like, I only needed him to wash the deck. Like, why is he doing the front lawn? Like I don't know, man. I haven't used a power washer in quite a while, and I had to borrow one. But I'm thinking it might be on the purchase list.
I mean, you get the electrical ones. They're pretty cheap. I got one myself.
So. Yeah, yeah. This one was electric. It was pretty damn good, though. It was, like, really powerful. So, I mean, they make ones that that'll take your arm off, but I haven't stepped up to that level yet. Maybe that's next.
That's when you get to that no coming back level of power washing. It's like, yeah, your wife is like, Scott, I'm sick of this. I looked at the water bill. It's $350. You got to stop doing this. And you're like, Alex, your arm's dirty. Oh, still.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I want a power washer that's so strong it could blow a hole in the side of the house. Like, that's what I want,
want a power washer that actually washes the house away.
Right. It actually blows the vinyl siding right off the side. That's what I'm looking for. But we'll start with what I got here. I don't know, man. And then I told you guys, if you tuned in, I think it was the last episode, if not the one before. I had an interesting day because I had two different worlds going on. I had to take my dog for a minor surgery, I guess. He had a basically a mass removed from his butt, really. And it's been there for a long time. Doctor said it was like an infected hair follicle that just kind of grows. And he was never really concerned about it. Took him in for some allergy things the other day, and the doctor there took a sample, and she's like, I found some mast cells in there. I want to get it out. Which, you know, God forbid it, you know, it spreads or whatnot. So I was like, let's get it in, you know, as quick as possible. So, of course, it wasn't cheap. $900 later. And it's weird being in the, dropping the dog off, because it's kind of like a doctor. Like, you're not allowed to go in. Like, you drop the dog off basically at the front, and the nurse meets you there. And he's petrified. The minute I get there, he's so shaking. He hates the vet. He hates the vet.
Is there a dog out there that actually loves the vet, or a cat?
I don't know.
Like, they all know. I mean, they all get that smell, and they just realize, oh, God, I'm going to get stuck with stuff, or people's going to put things in me.
Well, I mean, it's not like anything else. Like, it's like humans, right? You go to the hospital, you know that, like, you're going to maybe be there for a long time. You're going to get blood work if you're afraid of needles. You might get, you know, you're sick, you're afraid, you know. People are dying in that building. Like, the dog knows the same thing, you know.
I'm kind of curious. If my vet told me, okay, hair follicle, $900, I think I'd be like, all right, can I get a breakdown on this price? I'm kind of curious how this little a hair follicle, just by saying it out loud, seems like nothing.
Well, yeah, you're
right. And how it defines to near a grand. I'm like, I want a pure breakdown. I mean, I'm like, what's my scalpel fee?
Actually. And I would agree with you, Mike. Like, other vets that I've used, like when I had a different vet I didn't, you know, trust at the time. This guy has always been really good with, like, trying to save us money. Never, like, the reason he didn't cut it out the first time is like, well, we'll just keep an eye on it. If it grows or whatnot, then we'll take it. Like, he never rushed to get it out or anything like that. And I did get an itemized list, you know, but it's like catheter, the medication, the biopsy they got to do on it. Like, so it did give me an itemized list, actually.
Okay. Did it come with instructions where maybe you could have got a pizza cutter at home and gave Obi some CBD oil and then be all good?
It's no. I'd end up like cutting a leg off. Like, but it's funny. I did have a friend, his uncle has a farm. He's like, well, let me ask my uncle. He'll take that thing right off for you. I'm like, tempting.
<Yeah. laughs> Welcome to Uncle Jethro's Farm and Dog Surgeries. Yeah. Today we're going to remove a hair follicle. First off, what you do is you get the dog and you get it by the butt end. Then what you do is get a little string and you tie it to a doorknob.
Tie to
then
a tractor.
When the time is right, you just pull that doorknob and that falco goes away. Yeehaw! I saved you $700.
I feel like that's definitely a business in your neighborhood somewhere down in Georgia. There's definitely something going on there.
Well, Scott, you think I came up with the idea on my own? Come on now. You've known me long enough. I'm not the greatest ad-libber on this show.
Scott, you think I was improvising? I was just doing the commercial I saw before.
Didn't I tell you about the new sponsor tonight?
That would be awesome. So he gets, I mean, essentially they removed the tumor, basically, you know, a growth. And, you know, now I guess the follow-up is to see if it is anything more than, you know, a couple weird cells and whatnot. And God willing, it's not. Because the dog's been doing fantastic, like, health-wise. He's been really good. Like, he recurred. Basically, I don't know if you remember, maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, he had partially torn ACL and was limping all over the place. And he's basically healed from that. I changed his diet and dropped some LBs and a lot of rest at that time. And he's out walking. He's not sore anymore. So it's really interesting. So he's been really healthy. He's not that old. You know, he's almost, he'll be 9 this year. So he's not ancient. So you have no choice. You're stuck between, you know, you're not going to let this mass grow on your dog, you know, if you know it's, you know, cancerous, God forbid. So, you know, you have a 14, 15-year-old dog, maybe, you know, maybe they just let him, you know, it's more interruption. But, you know, I plan to have a whole lot more years with this dog. So, but
yeah, that's why you asked him to throw in the plastic surgery, so, you know, get those cheekbones fixed. So.
Oh, you should see his breasts.
I know. Scott, sometimes you show Obi and I see you kissing and I'm like, you didn't kiss him like you used to kiss him and all. So right. That's why I knew you had to go in and perk him up a little bit. He's a regal nine, but he needed a little touch-ups, if you will.
Right. So he comes out. I go pick him up. I'm nervous all day. Luckily, I had like a interesting. Here's again how comedy has intersected in my life. One of the vet techs is one of the women that we used to run the fundraisers for at Tap House 15 and the comedy shows. So she was actually, she's like, oh, I just met Obi. She messaged me. So, of course, I messaged her like, oh, how is he? Did he go in yet? Blah, 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 blah. You know, like, I'm annoying, probably really annoying. But he comes out. He's got the cone of shame on. It's huge. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a half English bulldog. So he's very low to the ground to begin with. You were good friends with Obi when you were up here. You know, he's probably like 2 feet off the ground. He's more width and girth than he is height.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's got all his 70 some odd pounds right at the top and all.
Yeah, right. Remember Mike Allstott? He's kind of like, Mike Allstott. I would like to interview Mike Allstott. I'm going to write that down.
I did look him up. I've been trying to find. I sent a message to a restaurant he owns. And it's just weird. It's like, hi, I don't know who works here, but can you call your owner and see if he'll do my podcast?
I've sent a few of those type of emails. So he comes out. He's got the cone of shame on. He's drugged out of his mind, man. You know, his pupils are like, he's kind of like just walking like one step at a time. He gets in the house, and when they got that cone on, they don't have any like depth perception, and he's so low. And our house is like a split level, so you have to go up the stairs to get to like the living room. And he's like bumping into the bottom stair because the cone's so high. I'm like, oh, man, poor guy. But that night, I took the cone off because the stitches are on his butt, and he couldn't get to his butt if he was like, you know, doing yoga for the last 3 years. He's too thick. He's like, I don't know. Try to bend a bratwurst like in half. Like you know, it's like he'd break before he could get to his butt.
Okay, I would say sometime next week, put a slice of cheese on his butt and report back if any of it. Could he obtain?
Yeah. Brillo, looks like I got to go in for another $900 for a drink because your experiment worked.
he has a broken spine.
And the wound is just gushing blood everywhere.
Side note, he loved the cheese. I mean, he really gave me a big old kissy for that. But, you know, he licked his butt. So I'm like, oh, God.
So all in all, he's back second day, back to normal, back to, you know, trying to get food. We took him for a walk. Seems fine. You know, I'm just worried about him maybe scooting his butt and tearing those stitches or anything. But he seems back to normal. So knock on wood, we are in the clear with that. So that was kind of an interesting day of quarantine. And I'm going to get the second part. I think I'm going to tell the second part maybe after our guest because we're coming up on guest time here.
Ooh.
And I'm excited to talk to this guest, Burlo. Who we got?
Tonight, Scott, we're going to be talking with John Bramblett. This gentleman is a blind painter, and he's considered one of the world's greatest blind painters. He's the only one in the world who does murals. He's done them for New York and Dallas. And we're going to be talking with him on when he came up with this skill and what's his passion with creating paintings.
Yeah, I mean, I checked out his website, you know, prior to doing this, doing a little research. It's pretty like phenomenal what the guy has been able to accomplish, and I'm really curious to find out how and what he really what that transition was like for him. So,
yeah, no joke. This is an artist. This is not a blind artist. This is a pure artist who just doubles down on the talent.
Exactly.
As we still trying to find a quarter of talent, this right. man has mastered a talent.
Yeah. We are, what was it? Plenty of handful. What did you say before?
very handful, limited amount of bad podcasts. Yeah.
You know what I used to name the episodes? Like trying to come up with clever names. That's what this one would be named. Yeah. But instead,
yeah, that's our old school naming.
Instead, we'll go with episode 286 with John Bramblett. So let's get
like all of John's friends is like, wait a minute, what is his name?
Not only that, that would be like the longest scrolling name for an episode ever. Verbal Shenanigans episode 286. Very, very handful
of limited bad podcasts. Yes.
So let's shift gears. Let's get the one and only John Bramblett on the line.
How are you doing?
I'm great. This is Scott here and Mike there from Verbal Shenanigans. Well, thanks for giving us some time here.
Oh, thanks so much for reaching out, guys.
No problem. I think we were grabbing the wrong John Blampett there in the moment.
Either that or you have two Skypes, or someone was like eating dinner with their family and we were definitely interrupting like over and over again. But so
who is this person calling you? I swear, honey, I don't know this person.
You just go downstairs with your John Bramblett. I'm going back to bed.
Awesome. Well, it's good, John. It's good to hear you guys.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Our pleasure. I mean, just want to kind of dive into it. I mean, for what I see, when you went to college, you kind of went into writing. Were you always interested in art, or where did you find that love for doing paintings?
Yeah, you know, growing up, I was sick a lot. Like, I was born with epilepsy and a kidney disease, and had a kidney out by the time I was seven, and the epilepsy got really bad, and then I ended up getting Lyme's disease. but I had art though. Like, wow. I would draw every day, just draw, and the great thing about art is it just takes you out of yourself. You know, you're not thinking about anything other than what it is you're doing. And if you're having a bad day, you know, it's awesome. And if you're having a great day, it's a great way to celebrate a good day. So either way, you know, art's awesome. But then in college, though, whenever I lost my eyesight, I didn't think I would be able to draw again. And so it was just, I don't know, the English just sort of made sense, you know, like trying to write and things like that.
Yeah, John, like looking on your website, I really like the like the about section, and you know, it goes through a lot of your accomplishments and whatnot, and we'll get to that in a few. Discovery Channel, Fox, and different things, and then it says, you know, he received these art awards, and John is blind. So it's amazing to me that, you know, one, you're able to do this and whatnot, but when you did lose your eyesight, was it in your life? Was it a complete hole of despair, or were you immediately kind of optimistic on how you can, you know, move forward from it and how you could adapt?
No, it was pretty much the hole of despair sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, it's in a hole is a really good way to put it, because I mean, I just felt like I had been dropped down in a hole. I mean, to be honest, and everything was over. I mean, like, Any hopes or plans for the future was just gone. I didn't see how it could work anymore. Anything in the future being new just seemed crazy and out of touch. And I was really depressed. I was so angry. I didn't even realize how angry I was. I was just, because I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing. Like, I was fortunate, and then I lost my eyesight in college. So. And the college was very proactive, you know, like I thought I had to leave. I already had epilepsy. And then now with the blindness, I thought, you know, that's not going to make things better. So I thought, you know, this college thing is just not going to work. But the university, the people there were like, oh no, you know, you can do whatever you wanted to, you can, you know, but I just didn't see how. I was learning Braille. I was learning O&M, or orientation and mobility training. That's where you learn how to use a white cane. Learning the screen readers for the computer, so you can do all this, you know, read and write on the computer, all this stuff. But how to cook without burning or poking yourself, which I didn't realize when I was sighted, like, you know, a kitchen's a dangerous place.
There's yeah, so right.
many different ways to, yeah. to burn, poke yourself. And, you know, you had to learn how to eat without getting food all over yourself usually. And just everything. I mean, it just seemed like the future was just a hopeless sort of thing. And,
now, John, yeah, real quick, so, for the listeners, you lost your eyesight due to complications with Lyme disease, or?
Yeah, it was complications with the Lyme disease and the epilepsy. The epilepsy just got worse and worse, and then I ended up getting Lyme disease, but it went undiagnosed for years because my neurologist just saw the epilepsy. You know, we weren't really looking for anything else, and so I was having all these problems that I had kidney problems in the past. You know, I had a kidney removed. So it just seemed like there was enough going on where they didn't have to look for anything new. And but the Lyme disease was there, and it was just causing other problems. And it was either the treatment for the epilepsy, trying to get that under control, or finally the treatment for the Lyme disease. But I started having the seizures where it was just status epilepticus, where you're having a seizure that you're not coming out of. And eventually, like, it was shutting down my breathing and my heart, and they would have to restart that. And it was a bad time where, and these seizures were causing brain damage, you know, and at the time it was, just, you know, the neurologists were just trying to get the seizures under control, and we weren't, you know, they weren't so much worried about the vision. You know, we thought if we could get the epilepsy under control, then the vision and all that will take care of itself. But, but it was causing damage to the occipital lobe, and so it was a mess.
Yeah.
So as you're going through all this, you're relearning everything from doing daily activities and getting along with your life. What would you say? What kind of time frame did it take you to say, I want to start enjoying things along with relearning life? And what kind of led you into the path of getting back into drawing?
You know, that's a good question, but it took about a year before I started trying to draw again. And, I was doing everything I was supposed to. Like, I was going to school, I was getting in completes and classes. The only good thing about what I was going through really was that I didn't have any homework. You know, I would go to class and I would get incompletes, but I couldn't read or write yet. You know, I was learning the screen readers and Braille and all that stuff, but I would still go to class. And, but I was learning how to use a cane at the time. I use a guide dog now, but I was learning how to use a cane. And after about a year, I could leave my apartment and I could find the university and then find the right classroom and travel independently. Sorry, my guide dog's over here right now. Just shaking.
No problem. We've got questions for him too, so don't worry.
Yeah.
great. Yeah, she'd love to answer.
This is controversial, but are you a good boy? Yes or no?
She's very good. Well, she's a girl, but she's so good.
Oh, okay.
She doesn't mind being called a boy. It's okay. But, man, you know, I was doing everything I was supposed to, and I was thinking that first year because I was learning O&M, you know, learning how to use a white cane, learning Braille, all this. So I was doing everything that I was supposed to adapt. But on the inside, I was just dying. Like none of this stuff was helping me feel any better. I still didn't have any hope for the future, but I could travel independently finally. You know, I went from being a very independent person to, when the eyesight went, you couldn't leave your apartment without getting bumps and bruises or scrapes. But finally, after about a year, I could use that cane and trail down the curb. And it occurred to me as I was using that cane, you know, which is, you're basically using your sense of touch to be able to find your way around a city.
Yeah.
And I was going down a curb and I thought, you know, this is so much like a straight line. And then it just runs into another line, you know, another street, and on and on. I thought, you know, if I could get across a city basically using my sense of touch, surely I could get across a canvas if I could use those same techniques, you know, just using my sense of touch. So, and that's when I started trying to draw again. But I was so angry and I was so depressed at that time. But I started using paint that I could touch and feel. So I would make a line and I could feel it on the canvas, and then I'd make another line and just started building it up from there, but it was a really, really slow process.
I mean, it's really amazing. Like, so I want to dive deeper into the process of you painting. So you, I know you, it says through your website you, and what you just said, you have a paint that you are able to feel. Now, like let's take a picture. Like I'm looking at your latest originals on your site, and there's one of a dog. Since we just brought up a dog, and you know, we're very dog centric here on the podcast. So
oh, brilliant.
So okay, so guide us through kind of like the stages of how you are able to do that. So for people who are able to paint normally, would draw lines and kind of figure it out and whatnot. Explain how you are able to do this and how does it come out so well?
Well, thank you so much for saying it comes out well. I appreciate that. But when I first started, it was very different. It was geometric, and I could only use like two colors. If it was a crazy day, then I was using three colors, you know.
Okay.
But that includes the black and white. So I see a black and white, and maybe red. It was like, wow, that's a crazy day.
Huh.
But no shading, no blending, nothing. You know, just very, very simple. So if you were to walk around my studio right now, I'm sitting in my studio and I'm surrounded by these paintings that go back like 18 years, and the first ones are extremely geometric.
Okay.
And then the modern ones, you know, have lots and lots of colors and very fine details and more shading and
for sure.
And blending. But it's baby steps, but it's still sort of the same process though. Like whenever I make a line, and I started drawing when I was a kid, and then I went on and I started doing drafting, illustration, cartooning, every kind of drawing that I could. You know, I took every kind of class that I could on it. So whenever the eyesight went, my brain still remembered how to draw and my hands knew how to draw. But the only thing that had been lost was the eyesight, you know, the thing that connects the two of those.
Right.
So, but one of the great things that we have about modern orientation mobility techniques when you lose your eyesight now is that it's all about using your hands to compensate for your vision. So you start learning spatial orientation. You start learning how to make mental maps by using your hands to touch and feel things. So whenever I started drawing lines, you know, I would feel the line, I would touch the line, and my hands are doing the work that my eyes would used to do. So I could feel, you know, where I would make the line. You know, and really when you're drawing, you're just using your eyes to know where you are and where you've been. You know, so like it's like when you make a mark on a piece of paper, you're looking at it, you're thinking like, oh, you know, okay, I'm right here, I want to go over here.
Yeah.
If you're visually impaired, you use your sense of touch to do that. So I can feel the mark now, you know, so it's a raised line. Or it's paint that feels different, you know, than what I'm painting on. So I can feel the mark that I'm making. I can feel where it's going. I can feel all the other marks I made. And the more marks that I make on the canvas, then the more information that's there. You know, it makes the map better.
Right.
And then with the paints, though, I Braille my paint so that I know what colors, you know, I can read the label, you know, using Braille. But I also have a little trick where I mix different mediums in with the paint to actually make the colors feel different. So I'll mix the paint so that like a white feels like toothpaste or a black feels like oil. And now when I put that paint on the canvas, there's even more to feel, you know. So I've got all these different textures to feel and I've got these lines to feel. You know, so it's
really cool.
It's a way of building it. It sounds hard, but you know, the funny thing about it, I do these workshops. I do workshops all over the country. You know, I've done them with the Met, the Guggenheim, the DMA, just all these.
Yeah.
And I go into schools and I go into – but my favorite thing is to go into schools, especially elementaries, and I'll blindfold the kids and I'll show them the way that I paint. And, you know, and I'll give them raised line drawings that I've made and different paints that I've mixed. And in 10 minutes, everybody's painting.
That's amazing.
And it's sort of a cartoon kind of painting.
It's probably wrong, but in a way you're almost creating like a Braille with colors. Does that kind of make sense? Like,
that's
a
great way to put it.
Okay. So like, yeah, black is this texture. Yellow is this that's pretty amazing, man. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It makes it a lot of fun. And honestly, like with kids too, like a lot of times kids are a little, like I work with a lot of kids and, sometimes kids are a little shy about getting into art or about sharing their art, but you know, once we're doing some workshops and we put blindfolds on them, we're playing music, we're doing all this stuff, the kids are laughing, they're having a great time, and they don't mind, you know, getting a little silly and you know, and if they can't see their artwork, they don't mind other people seeing it. I don't know.
Right.
Just everything up.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
That's incredible. I mean, you really sound like how you're very passionate about your art. Like one thing
looking up on you, it brings up how one of your favorite things to do is train museums on how to basically do shows for kids who are blind or special needs or anything like that. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do there?
Oh man, that is a blast. When I first started painting, I thought I was out of my mind. Like I literally thought I was crazy because I was just doing it because I was so depressed and angry. And I didn't tell people that I was painting. And even my first shows, I didn't tell people I was blind. So I wouldn't do a show opening. I would do like a closing because I just didn't want people thinking about the vision. And the shows ended up doing well. And then it got out that I was visually impaired. And then, which is the best thing that could have happened, because I started to be contacted by some different nonprofits and charities asking if I could come and do workshops with their clients and, you know, give talks and do all these things. So I started working with soldiers that had PTSD and children that had autism and adults that had Alzheimer's and all these different groups. And the best thing about it was that I felt like I was at home, really. Like all these people were like my best friends and we really got each other. You know, it's funny how people that have a challenge, you know, you just seem to relate to one another. And then museums started hearing about these workshops and they said, hey, you know, we want to be more inclusive. We want to, you know, we want everybody to be able to come to the museum and have a good time. Can you start doing workshops? So I started doing workshops there, and it just really blew up from there. I never thought that anybody would ever see a painting of mine when I started painting. It wasn't even a thought. It was just, you know, I just wanted to not go crazy. I just wanted stop being so angry and depressed all the time. And then it turned out to be this thing where I'm able to travel around. The artwork's gone to like 120 countries. Been able to travel around, meet people, and connect with people. You know, and that was the beginning. I just wanted to connect with people, just to reach out and let people know, hey, I'm still here. I'm still me in here. Never thought it would work. It's been a blessing.
So let me ask you something. This might come out a little weird, but so when you first got into the painting after you came out of, you know, losing your eyesight, did you have like someone around you who was like brutally honest with you, like okay, that painting is not looking great, like, so you were able to kind of coach yourself on how to improve? Like, were you able, like, did someone really help guide you to where you're able to really do these amazing, like, you know, we'll post them on our Instagram and Facebook when the interview comes out, on some of the pictures of you, but I can't imagine this came instantly being this good. There had to be a lot of trial and error. Was someone able to help you with that and help you figure it out and fine tune your skills?
Well, thanks again for saying the painting is good. I appreciate that. That's awesome to hear. In the beginning, there wasn't anybody in the very beginning, but it was a slow process.
Right.
And when I first started painting, it took a month to do a painting, like a little tiny painting. You know, it would take a month to do it.
Yeah.
And I was sweating bullets. You know, like it took so much concentration. You know, it was like I'd gone out for a run or something.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and just trying out different things, just trying out different techniques. And then later on, as I slowly improved, I started doing shows because I wanted to meet other artists, you know, and be able to talk with them. And I was fortunate that the college I went to is a big arts college. So so whenever I got my skills a little bit better, I was able to draw again, you know, a little bit more. I started talking to professors and other artists, and
right.
I'm a huge nerd. So one of the reasons that I can paint is because of the advances that have been made with screen readers and technology that we have. So
can you also explain that mm-hmm. too, the screen reader process? Because like,
that is huge. That is so huge. So only about 12% of blind people even read Braille anymore. And, because the main thing is just the screen reader.
Wow.
It's a software. Isn't that crazy?
Unbelievable. Yeah.
It surprises me, and I've been blind for almost 20 years now. But
Can I also intervene with a fact I learned about Braille reading? Like, the guy who invented Braille, Louis Braille, when he was in – he was a kid who lost his eyesight, and when he was in these private schools, he invented this whole – you know, he invented basically Braille for his you know, the other kids in the school, and basically the teachers didn't want him to really get credit for it, so they basically like banned Braille. Kids got in trouble for using it, and the guy died like years later And then Braille became widely accepted like years after his death. It's a pretty sad story, actually.
That's sad. They had like this raised letter thing that they were trying to push on the kids. But the Braille was so much better. And I heard that the kids would write little notes, you know, in bed at night, you know, using
it's
Braille.
It's crazy.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but I figured if I didn't throw that fact in there, I would never throw it. I would totally forget.
but it's kind of cool though in a way, because it just keeps progressing, and now like with the smartphones and the tablets and computers and whatnot, like in my studio I have a massive 3D printer, so I can print out all these different things. So artwork from around the world, like statues, this and that. I also have a massive touchscreen device that has software on it, so that this is the first time in history that people who are visually impaired can actually understand what a photograph looks like, you know. That's
so awesome.
And you're not looking at the photograph, but you can touch it. So like it's a touchscreen device where you can touch it, and it vibrates it as you touch the screen. So it'll turn the photo into lines. Wow. And it's a thin line, it'll vibrate a little bit, and a thick line, it'll vibrate a lot. It'll make different sounds, like did different tones for different types of lines. And it's just, I don't know, there's so much out there, and it's so cool, and it's just progressing all the time. I'm a huge nerd, so I'm always beta testing different apps and things, just because it's
right.
It's incredible.
Huh.
Even the guide dogs, like the guide dogs that we have now, like my guide dog who's snoozing down here, and she doesn't look like a genius right now, because she's asleep and she's kind of snoring, but even the guide dogs now are different than what the guide dogs used to be. Like back in the day, they might be able to take you to work and maybe a coffee shop.
Right.
But now, I fly on average two or three times a month, going to work with different charities and give different talks. And a lot of times it's just me and my dog. But with the guide dogs we have now, like if I'm in an airport somewhere and I want to find the men's bathroom, I can just ask her. And she'll find it wherever it is. You know, it's kind of like a bomb sniffing dog, but instead of bombs, she finds bathrooms. And then in the bathroom, she knows the difference between a urinal, a stall, a sink, a trash can. She'll remember what seat I was sitting back in the terminal and take me all the way back to that exact seat. You know, with a smartphone and a smart dog, you can do pretty much anything anymore. It's just crazy.
Not to mention if you had a smart guy.
Oh man, what? You know, believe me, it's mostly the dog.
Now, one thing I watched some of your YouTube videos, and you talked about how I'm not sure if it was your assistant or your wife. You were showing how you basically feel faces to figure out how to draw people on their pains. I'm kind of curious. Like, it was very interesting how you say how you broke down. Just like her ear from, all right, this is the top part, this is the middle, this is the bottom, and then you break those parts up equally. I see you also have done, like, big murals in, like, New York and Los Angeles. How much math is going into your head to kind of decipher, okay, this is a couple inches, I'm dealing with a bigger, like, a wall or something like that? How much math is into, okay, now half an inch equates to like a foot or something to that effect?
Man, not too much math, because I'm not that great math. but you know, like if it's a mural, like I'm about to do this 30-foot mural, and I always do it on a smaller canvas first. So I've done a couple of 4-story murals, and wow, that I'm in a boom lift. Jeez. But I have a canvas that'll fit in the boom lift with me, and it's textured, you know, the way that I painted it. And then on the building, I'll go out there and I'll start making lines on the building, and just sort of the way I do on the canvas. But with a big mural, my wife helps, and see, which is awesome. It's fun, because in my studio, I'm just in here by myself, but with that though, I'll have a radio, and she'll have a radio. And I'll so if it's like a forest scene on this giant building, I'll radio down and say, "Hey, you know that giant tree? How far away am I from that?" And she'll say, "Oh, you're 12 feet away." I go, "Okay, cool." And then I know where I am on the building. But a lot of times on the building though, what I tried to do is to incorporate the architecture. So whenever I draw when I make the initial drawing, I try to put in anywhere that there's a window in the building or a change in the brick pattern or or a pipe that's coming down, and I'll use those for transition points in the painting, if that makes sense. So that when I get to the building and I'm touching it, I can orient to that, you know, where I am on the building, and then I can match it up to where I am on the canvas. And it takes some time, but the compositions that I try to do for the big murals, I know going in, you know, what kind of the steps that I want to do, you know? So I know, right. Well, I'm going to work on this part first, then I'm going to work on this part. And, you know, I kind of break it up into bite-sized little pieces that makes it a little easier.
Now, John, this is another question I don't know how to phrase, because I am also stupid. So, so you, if you looked at your life and you divided it into the sight, the periods where you were able, you know, you had sight, and then where you were, you know, clearly you lost your sight, and now you look at how much you have done and how many people you are working with, and the amazing things you're doing and continue to do and grow, and you're having impact on people. Could you have ever imagined that your life would take a turn for obviously the worse, and then you made it so much better? Could you have ever imagined you would be here in your life?
No. No, I mean, to be honest, whenever I lost my eyesight, I thought everything was over.
Right.
Like all hope had just gone. And it's strange. I never thought about it before the eyesight went, but hope has almost a physical presence in your life. I mean, you don't realize how much space it takes up, you know, and then when it's gone, it just felt like everything was over. And I completely gave up on myself. You know, if it wasn't for the people around me that still believed in me, I mean, it would have been, you know, that would have been it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned a lot going through that. I mean, it's, you know, it was a horrible, horrible time, but no, I never would have thought that the things would have gotten better, you know, and I never would have been an artist. I mean, that really wasn't my thought, really. It was just I you know, felt so disconnected from everyone and was so angry and so depressed. I just needed a way to deal with it. And because of the eyesight going, I couldn't read or write for quite a while. And I could actually learn how to draw again before I learned how to read and write. So there for a while, my only way of really kind of releasing any sort of pent up, you know, anger or frustration was through the artwork. And that's still what I do. I was painting right before you guys called, and when we hang up, I'll start painting again.
You've been on a lot of different TV shows and been interviewed by a lot of people. I mean, you seem very happy and laid back, but is there ever a time where you feel, I don't know what, if upset is the right word, but when people refer to you as a blind artist versus an artist, does that ever like stick a nerve, or are you comfortable when people refer to you as that?
You know, I am now. Like, I don't, you know, it doesn't really affect me anymore. Like when I first started, I didn't even tell people I was visually impaired, and I didn't want people to think about that. And then, but whenever I started working with some different charities, and especially kids, and how important it was for them to own their disability, you know, and to right, you know, and stick up for themselves with it. And, you know, and there's a changing point in me, because I have epilepsy, you know, and then the blindness. And growing up, for the longest, I felt like the epilepsy and all, you know, it was like this monster, this thief, you know, that's always out there. You never know when it's going to jump out and run your life or run your day, you know, or
yeah,
just feel like, you know, it's constantly going after you. And then it was a revelation, I think, while I was painting, you know, that, you know, this, the epilepsy, the blindness, it's not like this monster. It's not this thing that's separate from you. You know, it is me. I have epilepsy. You know, there's some days that I'm more like a James Bond martini. I'm more shaken than stirred, really, you know? And, you know, in the blindness, it is just a part of me. You know, I have a certain hair color, I'm a certain height, I'm blind. It's just something that is me. And I think, you know, whenever I accepted that, a lot of the frustration and a lot of the stress really kind of, it went away, you know? And so I don't really think about it much anymore. And I think the more that I do talk about it, you know, the better it is when I talk to kids. You know, I fly on average 2 or 3 times a month. I go in and I work with museums, I work with schools, with galleries, and anywhere that I go in and I work with the museum, I'll generally visit the children's hospital. We'll go into, I'll give workshops. All my workshops are free. I just, I never charge for a workshop. So I'll go in with any charity that'll basically let me in and paint with their people, and we'll go in and we'll paint. And, you know, the more that I could talk about visual impairment, you know, and the epilepsy, and that it's just one of the aspects of my life, you know, but,
right.
You know, but I was blind. I was epileptic, you know, years ago, and I was sure that my life was over and I didn't have any hope, and I'm blind and I'm epileptic now, and I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. You know,
it's amazing. Yeah. Mm. I mean, we have had the pleasure of interviewing a lot of really inspirational people. We've had a paraplegic hot air balloon rider. We've had Trevor Thomas. He was a guy who was a blind hiker who accomplished all these. His whole goal was to go to like Mount Everest and whatnot. And John, we want to add you to the list because it's really inspiring to hear. And you know, you went through something that no one could ever imagine, and everybody, you know, kind of fears the most, and you've overcome it, and you've made yourself better, and you're giving back to society more than you can probably even imagine. So I want to thank you for coming on the show today, and it really was inspirational. I think you're really doing some amazing work, man.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that so much, and thanks so much for having me on.
No problem, man. And no problem. What's the best place for people to go check out your artwork or interact with you, or what's the best place for them to visit?
You know, my website, it's just my last name. It's bramblett.com. Mm-hmm. And on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, it's just my last name. It's just Bramblett. It makes it really easy for me to remember.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That's awesome, man.
Go ahead. One last final thing. So according to Facebook, you are the world's number one blind painter. Just out of curiosity, do you know other blind painters, and do you all have a rivalry where you hate each other and you brag to them that you're number one?
It's such a weird thing to rank, isn't it? No, yeah, I do know other. In fact, I have personally trained hundreds of visually impaired people to paint, and I've helped, gosh, almost, well, about 80 professional artists who lost their eyesight and to get back into artwork.
Wow. All right.
And it's just going to be, you know, in the future, it's just going to be one of these things where it's sort of a normal thing. I work with blind services with 7 different states. And one of the things is we're going in and we're teaching children how to paint because it makes their cane skills just explode. And I was just made a culture ambassador for the United States a few months ago. So we're starting to go into some other countries and start working with their children. So it's a weird thing, you know, in 5 or 10 years, you know, it may not be that unusual to see a visually impaired visual artist, which is also a weird thing to say, visually impaired visual artist.
Right, John, you're awesome, man, and keep doing what you're doing because you're doing some really special stuff.
Oh, thanks, guys.
John Bramblett, Mike.
Such a fascinating story, Noel, and just proves that with me, with all my senses, can't do anything even remotely close to these talented people we talk to
right.
every week.
It basically proves that we have all our senses and can't really use any of them very well.
No. I mean, Lord knows touch got me in enough trouble. As is.
Yeah.
So.
Lord knows sound isn't working for us because judging by our our listeners lately, that's not working either.
So. No. Well, we've been quarantined for a couple weeks, so definitely smell not in the highest ranks right now.
Yeah. Really fascinating. I could pick that dude's brain for a long time. So go check him out. Mm-hmm. Go support the arts. John Bramblett. All right, man. What a really fascinating interview.
It's guy's an amazing talent and an amazing guy to chat with. And I could have just chat away with him for a good 2-3 hours and not blink an eye.
I could have talked to him for a very handful of time. Like a very,
very handful.
No, John was you know, really inspiring. It's funny because if you guys go back way long ago, this was in the early days of rounding up guests. We had Trevor Thomas on, who was a blind hiker, and he was a really cool story too. And I follow him. He's still at it. So it's amazing what people can do when they, you know, God forbid, lose a you know, a whole sense, you know, like a life changing sense. So go check out John and his work. It's pretty phenomenal. So I guess jumping back, so the same day of Obi's surgery, I also had the first ever, if you will, Verbal Shenanigans virtual comedy show. I called it, Berlo, Virtual Shenanigans.
Sounds like an interesting name. I'm intrigued how you came up with it.
Yes. Some dude? Yeah.
But, some dude with a cool nickname?
No, it was you, so it definitely wasn't someone with
a cool nickname.
So, so long story short, if I got hired by another Scott Brennan, who followed me on Facebook when we were in college. His medical company was doing a comedy show, wanted to do a virtual comedy show. My immediate reaction was, no, this is not going to work. I'm not really interested in it. It's weird. But I said, look, I got to be able to pay my comics X amount of money if we're going to do this. He's like, okay. And he got back to his boss and he's like, oh, yeah, well, they'll do it. I'm like, oh, crap. So I said, okay, we'll give this thing a shot. We went over like some of the rules I thought would be good. Like I wanted the audience to have their microphones on. I wanted the guy running the meeting to be able to mute people, like if there was like weird noises going about, dogs or things in the background. And I wanted to be able to have each comic who went on kind of be like the main presenter on the screen. And we figured out how to do all that. It was pretty cool. So I went about setting up my basement, and I posted a picture of it if you guys want to check it out. I kind of set it up the best I could to kind of look like I had a stool and a mic stand. I had like an American flag backdrop. I even lit it from the back. So it looked, honestly, on camera, it looked kind of cool. Like it kind of looked like, oh, like if you were looking up at a stage. And I played much worse places. So it was it was better than a lot of those.
You look like you were at a place where you say, yeah, I have to buy two drinks now.
Yeah. And believe me, I definitely had two drinks leading up to that because I was nervous. nerves are going all day, plus the dog surgery. So I set it up, and I was able to set up I also set up a TV in front of me hooked to the computer, which was Zooming, if you will. And you were able to, so we had 44 people in the virtual show. And I bit the bullet. I was like, I'll go first. I'll kind of set it up. I made you guys do this and kind of, you know, asked you if you want to do it. So I'll take the proverbial host spot. We didn't do it like traditional host, like where I would bring up each comic. Cause that's too much flicking back and forth between, you know, camera. So I wouldn't be like, all right, next comic. So each comic brought up the comic after them. So and what I did was had all the comics, enter the room, but without their video on. So instead of them like me just staring at you, like waiting for my turn, you know, it's just blank. You know, it's just blank. And even when I logged on, I stood off to the side. So you just saw the microphone, you know, the light. So I was trying to give it like a little.
An ambiance.
Yeah, comedic ambiance, if you will. And so it was with four of the comics I trust the most and just great guys and girls. And, it went surprisingly well. There was enough feedback through the Zoom room that you can hear some laughs and you could hear, and you were able to do like crowd work. Like I was able to see someone be like, oh, you know, look at this guy, Berlo right here. Where are you, sir? You know, like, oh, nice dog in your lap, you know, and you were able to really interact. So I think I did pretty well for as good as, you know, as good as that can go. Mike Ciccoli came on. They loved him. Jackie Byrne and Kevin. And interesting. It was like, you know, at the end of the show, it went a little long. Next time I will try to shorten it and probably do less comics because it's not the same as sitting in a club. But at the end of the show, I get a message. The guy is like, hey, one of the people's sons wants to go on. He's like 8 years old or 10 years old or something. He wants to be a comic. I'm like, why not? Kid went up and killed, man. He did 5 minutes. He was awesome.
Is it true that when they said that, you went to the camera and it's like, damn it, that was Doug Max?
No, but I did make fun of him when I got. I said, man, you know, this kid's first gig, he's a headliner. And he had a joke about gingers in his set. I'm like, screw this kid, you know? But it was cool. I put up everybody's Instagram handle. We got a couple followers out of it. Afterwards, immediately, like, nice job. We'd love to do it again maybe in a couple weeks. I was talking with someone today about doing another one for a different company. So, you know, if this is going to be the new normal for a little bit, I was as skeptical. We were all kind of freaking out beforehand, like, this is going to suck, but let's do it. Let's get through it. We can laugh about it if it's terrible. And the consensus was that everybody actually had pretty fun, like, a good time.
So your goal in life is to be the Dangerfields in the cloud.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it was kind of cool to like do my set and then go sit on my couch, you know, like, and watch the rest of the show, like not travel, like, you know, so many places. I'm driving an hour and a half. Like, I was done and I just like went upstairs and started making dinner. You know, it was a very interesting experience, but I even messaged Howard Berger, the makeup artist, because we were talking about it on that episode, mm-hmm. if you remember. I was like, I told you I'd fill you in on how it went. And I was like, pretty good. And he actually responded to me. He was like, yeah, that's pretty cool, man. He's like, I guess we have to get used to trying to do creative things differently during this time. So it's interesting.
Is it true Alex looked at you and said, this is what you've been wasting 2 years of our life together doing?
Oh, no. She says that pretty much every gig that I come back with a $20 bill in my pocket and 100 miles on the car. Yeah.
You know. But, babe, the wings I got, they were, you know, average. I mean, this is better than the usual average food that we get at comedy clubs.
It's so funny because everything just always – you're just – you know, every time you think you're getting ahead, something always pops up monetarily. Like, I had this jar that I was putting all my comedy money in February and March, and was gonna, mm-hmm. we're going to use it to, like, buy a new bed. Like, we want a new bed and a mattress. And I had a good amount of money in there. And I also had, like, 3 good paying gigs coming up that got canceled. And then OB surgery comes up, and sure enough, I took $700 and something out of the jar, and the surgery was $900. But it's like, well, there it is, man. Life always has a way of just kicking you back in the balls.
Oh, well, honey, we'll just have to look back at our ad for Sleep Ovation and remember when we had a good bed.
Yeah, yeah. Mattress modeling, God. it's funny you say that because there is a chance. Maybe not anytime soon, but we may be back with Sleep Ovation again in the future. But that is not the announcement for later. But
Dang, you're teasing us, Scott.
I am. A huge announcement coming in. But, Berla, what do you got?
Well, I've been going through the news, and I came across a little gem here that I absolutely love of all the weird stories I could come across. And I'm trying to figure out how to present it to you. I think I almost want to make it like a little game
for
you to try to figure out. Now, I will preface it. It's a story out of Colombia. So have you heard anything out of that country
in cocaine recently?
Other than that?
Well, no.
I know what you do on the weekend, Scott. I'm talking about on the regular news.
No. All right. No, I have not heard anything on the regular news. I've been actually trying to avoid the news a little bit.
Okay, so I'm going to go through the story. I'm going to try to avoid the little angle here.
Okay.
And I want you to kind of guess what is occurring in this country.
Okay. All right. Give it to me.
All right. So Maria Jarmila awoke in the middle of the night to the sound of her panicked mule.
Mm.
When she looked out across her small yard, her confused turn to shock as Blank has wandered down her driveway and was inspecting her house. Any guesses so far?
So her mule was panicked. Something was inspecting her house.
Yes.
I'm going to go with it. Right now I'm thinking it's another animal of some sort, and the mule is going there. I don't think it's a person. I'm going to go with some kind of animal so far.
But I'm looking for specific guesses.
Oh, okay. Is there more to the story? Can I try to...
I'll keep going.
Okay. I'm going to go with... So at this point, I'm just at some kind of animal. Go ahead.
All right. Since that night in 2018, blanks have kept coming, wandering down back streets of rural Dordal, a small Colombian town, a four-hour drive from Medellin. Occasionally, blank will appear on the local soccer pitch to graze. An estimated 80 blank, perhaps more, live in the area around the Rio Magdalena, Colombia's principal head, which runs through the center of the country.
80 something. Big animal. So something she could see.
Yeah. I will add to the next sentence that this all started by the infamous drug lord Pablo Escobar for his own personal collection.
Oh, God. Something about that sentence you just said sounds familiar, and I can't remember what it is. God. Not tigers. Not zebra.
I'll keep going.
Okay.
In the 1980s, during the height of his power, Escobar kept blank in a private zoo on his 5,500-acre estate, where he kept a private zoo stocked with exotic animals such as elephants and giraffes. Following Escobar's death in 1993, most of the animals were taken to new homes or died, but not blank, because of the money it would cost to transport them.
Okay.
But while Escobar's estate fell into despair, blank thrived. The conditions around Hacienda Naples are ideal for blank. They live in the area's largest lakes and waterways, enjoy endless grass pastures to graze in, and they have no natural predators.
I want to say, I think I know, I for some reason, I think I know what this is, because I think I remember something about him, something about racing them and whatnot, or but I'm going to go with an ostrich.
Nope.
No.
Damn. No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Okay. So far, blank has refrained from attacking humans, but as their numbers grow and they expand into more populated areas, experts fear an attack could be inevitable.
Okay. It's not bears, is it?
No, it's not. It's not a bear.
No bear news. Got it. All right.
Yeah. Blanks are also having an impact on the native flora and fauna, with indications the presence of animals is displacing some local species. A new study by researchers at the University of California, San Diego, found that blank are changing the quality of the water in which they spend much of their time in.
Wow. Not hippos, is it?
Scott Brennan, Colombia has a hippo problem.
No.
Since Pablo Escobar apparently snuck into the country four hippos from Africa, and after he lost his power and the death, they were the one animal they couldn't get rid of, and they estimate there's at least 80 hippos running in Colombia, destroying the ecosystem.
Wow.
It is the most beautiful thing to go from a drug lord to hippos.
I find it amazing that only four of them were able to cause that explosion in population, you know?
Well, I would only assume at least there was one male and one female.
No, of course, but I mean, like, even, like, the speed, the amount of time it would take to, produce a bunch of hippo babies, I assume would be a decent amount. They're big animals.
I'm kind of curious.
I'm going to go with the gestational period for a hippopotamus is 11 months. gestational period of a
baby. For a hippo.
For a hippo.
243 days, so almost a year.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah. So 243 days.
That's 7 months.
Okay.
So that's less than a human.
All right. So, yeah, it's a decent amount of time, you know, like unless you're having twin hippos, triplet hippos, trippos. But, yeah, interestingly enough, you know, one of the, I know we say this all the time, but it doesn't matter because we're, you know, we can.
Some of you are new.
Yeah. This show, the antithesis, if you will, of getting interesting guests. Now, I tried to get interesting guests that I knew early on in the show. Like, it would be like a friend, a comic, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it started kind of sprouting a little bit when I was writing this bit on a hippopotamus's birthday. Correct. Yes, I know. And we were just talking in the car, and like we started spitballing. And like one of the things was like we wanted to get a hippo attack survivor on. So we called and whatever, tweeted. And I don't remember the exact process. But one day I get a call on the on my voicemail, and I like was going to completely ignore it and delete it. And I was like, hey, this is Paul Timbler, hippo attack survivor. Got your message. And sure enough, later we had him on twice. We became friendly with his assistant, who got us numerous guests, including mm-hmm. Dave Andrechuk. And a couple of weeks ago, she came back into our lives and got us Jenny Carreri, who we tried to help her solve the murder of her sister. So hippos have a special place in our podcast lore, if you will.
Yeah, and one little piece you forgot to add. When we first contacted him, and he didn't get back immediately, we kind of mocked him on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And part of the voicemail was, so I heard what you guys said. So, I think he said we were kind of interesting, but...
Yeah, yeah.
But he kept with us, and it brought us on this long little crusade. So. Yeah.
And that's one of the craziest stories ever, that hippo attack survivor. Paul Templer is his name. You can go look him up. But he lost an arm. He was inside a hippo's mouth. And it took them a long time to get him through the... It's just an amazing story. So if you could find that episode, go way back and check that one out. It's really interesting. And now apparently they're taking over Colombia.
Yeah, on top of it, apparently the estate that Pablo Escobar had has turned into a water park.
Really?
And yes, and... The hippos are there, and they have to feed the hippos to make sure that they don't go after guests. So
you're like going down like a body slide, and there's just hippos like on like the side of you.
Well, they have like those, you know, like those wooden cutouts where you put your head in. They actually have them where like little kids put their head. They're like, oh, I'm getting eaten by a hippo. But there's literally a guy's job to feed the hippos to make sure they stay at bay and don't try to come into the park.
I'm also picturing Pablo Escobar's water park. Like, oh, I'm going to go down the cocaine canyon. Like, you know, like,
all the water is like white and you're going through this guy's nose. And then you hear machine guns in the background.
You're in a little white tube and you enter the nostril. You know?
Yeah, and then your exit point is just going into a map of Florida.
Yeah. Man, that just reminds me of Narcos. Did you watch Narcos? Oh my God, you should watch Narcos. That was phenomenal.
I haven't seen that.
Phenomenal yet. Show as far as Pablo Escobar is concerned. So, yeah, all right. Well, you know, good luck to all our Colombian listeners. You know, try to avoid the hippos on the way to work and whatnot. I wonder if, like, because the hippos were exposed to Pablo Escobar, and how that operated, I wonder if the hippos have kind of formed their own cartel, like where there's like a lead hippo. He's kind of like laying back and has other hippos doing his work for him. And, you know, like they got a product they're pushing. You know, I wonder.
I'd be interested, like, if, like, the one that's still out there, like, the main hippo from the original four, he's like, this is my turf. I came here from the streets of Africa.
Right.
I ran these Columbia waters for many years and all. You, anything you want to do, you got to go through me. You understand?
Right. Isn't that the plot of Scarface? Like, he comes in from another country, works his way up, starts to have a cartel. Just the hippo version of it.
Yeah, they really shouldn't have showed those hippos that movie. Now it's just total chaos. If they just showed them something like lighter, like a Disney movie, they'd be perfectly fine right now. But no. Some guy had to show the hippos Scarface, and here we are.
They're like the most powerful force in Colombia. I can't be messed with. They got the cops bought out and everything like that. Like, oh, no. I didn't. It wasn't me. I didn't kill that canoer.
You just see a hippo walk up, open its mouth. It's just full of cash in there for the cop to pull out of it. I didn't see anything.
Well, I once saw a hippopotamus's birthday party at the Camden Aquarium, and it was someone's job to feed that hippo, and they just like opened their big old mouths and like they had a cake for them. But before that, they were throwing in like heads of like I think it was like cabbage or lettuce or whatever, and they were just kind of like placing them into the hippo's mouth, and they have like four nasty teeth, so it's more like the chewing is just more of like finding the thing in your mouth. Like it just slices it eventually.
Like that lettuce has to like circle around for like 10 minutes. The hippo's like, get over there. Get over to the fourth one. Get over there.
Yeah. It's like that guy from Tiger King. He's got like three teeth. I imagine that's how he has to eat. But yeah, that's something Paul was telling us, that the tusks on the hippos are so like nasty and whatnot. Like, they'd puncture him, and the big danger is there's so much infection that it brought into his body.
I wonder if that guy from that birthday party like got a call one day and, oh, you saw my resume on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a lot of experience feeding hippos. Why do you ask? No, I've never been to Colombia. How much? And I get a free pass to the water park?
I'm in. On his resume, it's like Camden Aquarium, Escobar's Cocaine Hippo Alley.
Escobar's Wild Cocaine Ride.
I love it. Well, good for Colombia. I'm surprised I guess they're actually trying to be like civil. I feel like you could take care of the hippo problem with like a machine gun.
I'm sure they got to have like a Peter or something down there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure somebody's like, I'm just going to shoot it. And they're like, no, you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only explanation I could see why to do. Well, the other problem they're saying is like, they think there's about 80 of them, but the rivers are apparently like so deep that know like hippos can be just laying down there for hours on end where they don't. Every time they come around, they can't count them.
I'm fascinated by hippos. They are, they're like strangely fast, strangely fat, but strange. They're like little armored tanks that just like, they're like submarines that just kill people.
Yeah, they're like a very cool boss in one of them video games. Like one of them Super Marios, it's like, you get to like level 6, it's like, all right, I know a hippo's coming at some point.
Remember King Hippo from, Punch Out.
Oh yeah,
you had to hit, too easy. You had to hit him in the Band-Aid to drop his pants, and he'd be like,
and he always had the same thing. You know, he had the fist at his mouth and the fist at his belly button. Yeah. So you had to get the pattern.
If we were doing Mount Rushmore, of like Nintendo, I think Punch Out might be on the Mount Rushmore of Nintendo games. Such a good game.
I can't fathom it not making mine. Yeah, I mean it's. It's the only way I could fathom it not making it, because when I usually do that, I try to give one spot to each kind of category. So yeah. The only way I could see it not making it is saying if I have a classic slot and I would give it to Super Mario.
Yeah. Right. I agree. It was funny. One night, me and my friends were, so don't take this idea. We were hanging out around the table, having a couple beers and talking. And we were talking about how. It'd be really cool to make like a Punch-Out movie, like a really stylized, like basically the story of Punch-Out with like Little Mac and going through the different bosses and whatnot, but like in a real movie and, you know, with the coach, like, you know, and like the running scenes in his pink sweatsuit and everything like that. And
And maybe take out the racist names in three quarters of the fighters.
What do you mean? Piston Honda isn't... Piston Honda, when he came back, he was tough, man. He got, like, fast. Remember you fought him a second time later in the game?
Mm-hmm. That's what... Yeah. Okay, he's the Asian one. What? The Tiger one, I remember, like, he would just, like, magically...
He comes,
like,
back, too.
Around.
Persian... I don't remember. But, yeah, we were saying...
Like, I'll look up the name.
It'd be going. Really cool to be, like, really stylized. Like, almost like... You know, like, Sin City? Like, that kind of, like, really stylized kind of graphic, half cartoon, half, you know, realistic, and all the characters kind of being... But with all the old sound effects in there, too, like, when, like, guys get knocked down. I think, like... But like the but the blood and stuff is like red and slow motion. The star punch, you know what I mean? Like, it's like real slow mo, like Matrix style. Like, I could see it in my head really well. But
okay, I got the list up here.
All right, go ahead.
Obviously, the first one's Glass Joe.
Oh yeah.
The German is Von Kaiser.
Yeah, he was easy too. He would just do boom, like that weird like hip punch he threw.
Yep. Piston Honda.
Yep. He had cool shoes. Piston Honda had cool shoes.
Don Flamenco.
Yeah, with a rose in his mouth.
Mm-hmm. I don't... What could they be alluding to? King Hippo. Indian... Well, Great Tiger.
Great Tiger. Maybe that was Persian Tiger.
Yep. Bald Bull.
This is where they start getting hard. Bald Bull wasn't easy... he had super like knockout power, so it was very tough.
Okay, then Piston Honda comes back a second time
with the one then eyebrow. He had like the Rock eyebrow.
Mm-hmm. Then we had
Soda Popinski,
who apparently in the arcades is Vodka Popinski.
Yeah, you gotta love his character. He was just like a drunk Russian guy. It's great.
Yep, Bald Bull rematch, Don Flamenco rematch, then Mr. Sandman. I know he was a tough one.
Super hard.
Then Super Macho Man, I guess not to give Randy Savage any money by saying super.
Yep.
And then our friend Mike Tyson, or if you get the non-Mike Tyson one, Mr. Dream.
Yep. I had Tyson, and I think I got to Tyson maybe once, like... It was so hard to get all the way through, you know, because you'd have to go back down to the beginning of your, like, flight, I get, like, kind of like, there was, like, three people per flight or whatever, per, I don't know.
Yeah, the last one is five, so I think it brought you down to Popinski, if I recall.
I never, I'm going to admit, guys, I never beat it.
I never did either. I remember I had the code for a while so I could try to train on Tyson. I've knocked him out a couple times, but I never got the TKO on him.
Remember Game Genie? Like the
oh yeah,
the thing that you hooked to your game. Like it's so crazy that even worked, you know?
Because you couldn't even push it down. It's for some reason it works by just shoving it further into the game.
Yeah.
Instead of the natural push it down. Which makes absolutely no sense, but...
And basically, it was a thing that would give you, like, codes and extra... Like, it had, like, kind of information on basically, you know, information on the game. And it would give you codes and cheat codes and things like that. So it was, like, very strange that actually worked. So, yeah, I don't know. You just went away. I guess I just went away with you, too. But yeah, Game Genie was this thing you just shoved onto your game. Like picture nowadays you have like a PlayStation game like on a disc, and you just have like a extra disc that's slapped onto the top of it, and somehow gave you all the cheat codes.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be as natural as like a nerd disc. It'd be like a donut, and then you'd have to keep like the lid open as it was spinning.
Nintendo was so innovative, if you think about it, because a lot of those things, those ideas didn't even come. Back for like the power pad I had where you had to run on it and then jump and then run on it and jump. Like there's nothing really like that until like the idea of like Wii and like these virtual kind of things came up. But there was a huge gap from Nintendo to Wii, all the way to Wii and whatnot, and like the dance games and all that stuff.
Yeah, Nintendo released like 8 different weird things, and then everybody's like, well, 9% of this is crap, so we'll just go back to controllers for a little while.
Yeah.
And then we realized we were all getting fat, so that's when the Wii came out.
Yeah. Nintendo still. And Super Nintendo is probably my favorite as far as game-wise, but Nintendo, Super Nintendo, like, that's where the majority of my gaming life would reside, like the deepest I ever went, I guess.
I would say, yeah, I went to Genesis, and then I did one PlayStation 1. I think that was my end of my career.
Yeah, I have a PS4, but it's basically my Netflix machine because I don't have a smart TV, and I play rounds of FIFA every once in a while, which are like 12-minute long games, but that's about
it. Well, why don't you try to shove the Game Genie into your PlayStation 4 and see if it works.
All I got to do is find the Game Genie and you're on, baby. Like,
yeah. If you don't find a hole, just open it up and shove it in there. It will find a way to work like it did back in the 80s.
I wonder, do new games even still have cheat codes anymore? Like, are there still codes anymore? Like, is that just a thing of the past?
I think it's a thing in the past. Me too. Even like if you get the Mortal Kombat games, like in the past, you would have to either read up or find like exactly, okay, down, back, B, A, at this and medium mm-hmm. distance, does this kick or this throw or something like that. Now it's like literally, all right, pause the game, go to my tutorial, my character. Okay, this is my character.
Damn. Up, down, left, right, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, select, start, or whatever it was. Contra, whatever the Contra code was. Infinite lines. Those are better times, man. The simpler games were just better times. Like, the games were like, bro, you could come over and pick up the game and know how to play in 8 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, right now, if like I wanted you to play, like, I don't know what's big right now, Fortnite or Call of Duty or one of those games, I would have no idea how to play, and it would probably take me like a month to really have any idea what I'm doing.
Easily, because like every controller does it. That now they got camera angles, so you'd probably spend like 10 minutes. All right, I want to move forward. What the hell? Now I got a long view. What the hell? Let me press this button. Oh, I used up all my special powers. That's great. Now I got to go 3 hours before I find another hand grenade.
Yeah. Best Nintendo game for me was River City Ransom. Not sure if you ever played that one. The best. You're basically these two dudes. You walked through these, you know, it's like a side-scrolling fighting game, but you earn these coins and whatnot, and you basically, you would have to purchase things like food, and you could read these books. And if you read these books, you would earn these skills like dragon fists and kick, and like you would beat these gang members up. And you had to kind of rescue these girls at the end, and you could throw things at people. And it was kind of like there was a little looseness to the game where it kind of was like way ahead of its time, like where you can kind of roam around and go learn new skills and upgrade. And this was Nintendo.
Yeah. I think mine would have been The Adventures of Bayou Billy. It was tough as hell.
Never heard of that. But
yeah, it's basically like, it's probably around the same concept and all. Like, you're this Australian guy trying to, going through like the desert and trying to get the girl at the end. But it would have like different sets to it. Like there'd be like a driving set where you're like driving a plane. There's a beat up set where you're just like side scrolling. It had different pieces to it. It was hard as hell. You like getting through level one was near impossible half the time. But
yeah, some of those games back then, they didn't give a crap. They're like, this is a hard game. You can't, you're not getting through this, you know?
Oh yeah. There was always the one that you just threw your controller for the like first 3 weeks because it was just cheap and like it didn't care.
Yeah, some of those games are so hard, but yeah, that kind of talk makes me nostalgic. I think I just said nostalgic because I just combined me and nostalgic into one word.
Put on a t-shirt. Let's see if we can sell a couple of those.
Well,
tape it to the back of the Verbal Shenanigans t-shirts.
Verbal Shenanigans, nostalgic on the back.
Very handful of limited bad episodes.
A very nostalgic. We do English good. Well, I guess, Berlu, before we get to a tip-top announcement, do you have any news or anything to promote for us? I think we get a new, aren't we on a new outlet?
Yeah, we're getting the details on it, but But let me bring it up here. We are going to be joining a new podcast network called the RTF Sports Network. We've been chatting away with the heads of that group. They're starting a kind of like a current event slash interview, social media kind of group. So I don't have the full details if we're going right onto the RTF Sports Network right now as is, but yeah, we're joining a new group and all. We're getting excited about that. They seem to have a gang and a staff there that's got pieces with social media and items like that. So,
yeah,
you know, excited. Yeah, a new audience to get onto.
Yeah, cool. So, yeah, we are also on, let's see, Discovery County Network. We are on comingrightup.org, I believe. We're on Denville Radio. You know, there's various outlets to get us, BS Podcast Network. And I say that so you can go really support the other people on that, the other programs and the other artists on those networks, because it's not just us. So it's kind of like a collaboration of artists and whatnot, where they, you know, they do a good job of helping us, and we appreciate being on there. So, Berlo, I guess I had teased this at the beginning of the episode a long time ago, so I wonder if anybody is still listening. But, Berlo, any idea of what the announcement could be?
I'm going to guess it has something to do with fish, and just cross my fingers.
Nothing to do with fish, Berlo. Sorry.
Damn it. Every time I guess that, it never works out for me.
All right. Berlo, would you like a second chance?
We'll be here all night, so you might as well get to the announcement. It'd be hard to believe somebody's still here. But
okay. Okay. So, special announcement in the Verbal Shenanigans. The Verbal Shenanigans family is growing.
Oh.
So, come October, there will be one more Brennan in the Verbal Shenanigans clan.
Okay.
So what I'm telling you is I am having a baby.
Woo!
Thank you. Thank you.
You questioned me about the baby totals after this pandemic, and look what you just did.
Yeah.
Literally, when this pandemic started, you're like, yeah, me and the wife look at each other and we're like,
well,
I don't know.
Bro, I also, you know, the magic of acting, you know, I even said we were having that good conversation the other night that I do keep things close to the vest sometimes. So it also makes it better for conversation. But yes, we have known for, when we are recording right now, what is today? Today is Saturday before Easter, so tomorrow we are actually announcing it. So I wanted to tell you before we throw it out there on the old social media land.
All right, I'm on Facebook tagging you right now, so go on.
Breaking news. Wow, that would be like the biggest, that would be the biggest asshole move ever. Hashtag, did you hear Scott Brennan's having a baby? Tag Alex in it. Oh, my God.
Oh, Lord.
So, it's been a long journey.
Stop talking about your penis.
No. Yeah, it's definitely a short, short story. Not even a very handful. Not even a very handful. But so in full confidence, full whatever. So in
nostalgia,
yeah, yes, nostalgia. I'm just gonna call this episode "Verbal Shenanigans Butchers English."
again.
So in November, actually, we had a miscarriage. So this was this was a long time coming, and not to be too graphic, if you will. But I think we only did it maybe one, like this was complete surprise. We probably did it one time to like after this had kind of all happened and whatnot, and we were kind of easing our way back into romantic life, if you will. So Super Bowl Sunday comes, And
oh, you had money on the Chiefs. Okay, I see where this is going.
So Super Bowl Sunday comes, and we went to an event up the street where, like, at the clubhouse, kind of by where we live in the lake life. And it was like a potluck dinner. Like, you bring something. So everybody brings something, right? You know? So we eat and whatnot. And Alex, in the middle of the night, starts getting very violently ill and kind of gets, like, food poisoning. Okay? Mm. So I have work the next day. She stays home from work. And she's like, oh, I'm like, all right, well, just call me if anything happens and whatnot. And I get a call. She's like, can you please come home? I got to go to the emergency room. Like, I'm throwing up. So I had a friend. There was a friend that we had at the time. We still have her. But at the time, she was unemployed, so she was home. I said, can you do me a favor? Like, I can take a half day. I can get out of here in, like, an hour and a half, you know, two hours, whatever. But I can't take this right now. Like, I can't just leave. Can you take Alex to the the minute clinic, the urgent care? And so Alex went, and she's throwing up, and she had to, you know, take a basically pee in a cup or whatever. And they're like, any chance that you're pregnant? And she's like, no, definitely not. I don't think so. And you're like, all right, well, we'll take this test, because there's, like, one medication that's fine and one that's, like, not good if you're pregnant. You know, like, so it was, like, nausea medication. Comes out, apparently, and they're like, well, you're pregnant. And so her and my friend found out, our friend Hillary found out before I did. So, like, total shock. I come home. I get her home around 12:30. And I'm like, how you doing, honey? You feeling all right? I'm okay. You know, she's kind of got, like, the puke bucket, like, and, like, the water and the Gatorade, when I had bought her some Gatorade and whatnot. And I get in, and she's like, well, there's also this. And she throws it at me. And it's, like, a little pregnancy test. I'm like, no way. She's like, yeah. So
I think it would have been funnier if she threw you the prescription that you couldn't take because she was pregnant, like, make you guess. Yeah. Honey, I don't know why you can't take Pepto. Please spell this out.
So needless to say, after what had happened, we were very worried. And during this pandemic, I haven't been able to go into the last two appointments or whatnot. It's been interesting. Like, kind of sucks because, like, the heartbeat appointment or whatever, like, when you hear the heartbeat, which we were nervous about, you know, I had to be in the car and they put it on speakerphone. And then the last one, which was, like, a scan kind of before, some kind of scan, whatever, to see the development. I didn't get to see any of it. And apparently you got to see the kid move and stuff like that. So kind of blows. But I've been saying it's kind of like maybe it's a, you know, because if we were going through the first one, the June kind of would have been like the due date, June, May. So like going through all this during this wouldn't be very fun. So, you know, maybe the blessing in disguise.
Yeah, I think it's in your favor just because now you have more time at home with her. And,
yeah,
I mean, considering the history, you can do certain things where, you know, keep her calm, keep her safe. You know, get yourself more entwined with each other.
Yeah.
With the situation.
Well, it's funny because I said to her, I said, look, you know, it's crazy with work and everything, but you're never going to have a pregnancy again, you know, if we ever have another child, God willing, this goes okay. You're never going to have a pregnancy again where you're home and you're in your house and you're, you know, somewhat comfortable and able to. So, like I said, take advantage of it, you know. So it's been a wild ride, but yeah, Verbal Shenanigans onesies will be available in maybe October.
And the kid will be named Fish, so my prediction would have been correct.
Right. Fish Brennan is what we're going for here.
That is oddly awesome sounding.
Sounds like
I promised Burley, what can I do?
It sounds like a terrible special at, like, a diner. We have we have pork chop Murphy, we have egg salad, and we have Fish Brennan.
Oh, God, who gets the Fish Brennan?
They still make that? But, so, that's
the... Well, I'm happy for you, buddy.
Thanks, pal. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story, and congrats to you and the wife, and fingers crossed, when this is all said and done, your child is in a normal life where they can actually go outside in April.
Absolutely. So, yeah, maybe I should have put that at the beginning of the episode, but, you know, hey, it's called Building Suspense, Berlo. It's Building Suspense. It's Radio 101, which is why we don't have any listeners. But, guys, I'm going to end it there. We could talk way more about this on, you know, on our next episode and whatnot. So, guys, stay safe out there, and check our episodes out. There's a lot of different stuff. If I could recommend one other than tonight, I would go back to Howard Berger 2 episodes ago. Just a really fantastic interview, one of my favorites that we've done to date. Follow us on iTunes and Stitcher and Instagram and Facebook and all that fun stuff, and just share us with people and give us a review on iTunes. So, guys, that's it. Stay away from the hippos. Get yourself a power washer and go make yourself a baby, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
Later.
Now close your eyes. We'll spin around, say, part time. You could find ain't the way that you want. But it's still alright.